So, first of all, very fast oscillations are oscillations over 80 hertz, and they do occur. They do occur in normal neocortex. Is this? Huh? Oh, that's what's going on. Okay, that's better. Okay, so very fast oscillations do happen in normal neocortex and hippocampus as well. They occur during cortical activations. So here we go. So for instance, this figure is from Jones et al. 1999. This is a whisker stimulus, and here is a recording inside the barrel cortex. And on the upstroke reaction to the stimulus, you see very fast oscillations riding on this wave, and you also see very fast oscillations during the upstate of slow oscillations. And very fast oscillations are also tied to temporal lobe epilepsy. It's the most common form of epilepsy. It's almost always linked with some sort of lesion or cortical malformation in the brain. Seizures can start either around the lesion, or they can start in the hippocampus. Wherever they start, it's called the seizure onset zone. They tend to be tractable to medication, because we already know this. And VFOs tend to be more widespread in the seizure onset zone. And that's what this figure shows here. This is from Worrell et al. So the columns on the left stand for instances of very fast oscillations found inside the seizure onset zone versus very fast oscillations found outside the seizure onset zone. And you see that there are a lot more of them found inside the seizure onset zone or not. So it's not that very fast oscillations in and of themselves are abnormal, but around seizure onset zones in particular, you see a lot more of them. And you also see them particularly at seizure onset as well as during seizure. So here's a figure from Grenier et al. This is taken from LFP recordings inside a cat, seizure induced by ketamine, xylazine, anesthesia, and this is the general EEG, and here's the filtered EEG, and you see that where the seizure starts, you also see very fast oscillations happen at the same time. So here, and then also here in two seizure instances. So they're linked together. They're correlated. Okay, and very fast oscillations are also occur more often around a lesion. So temporal lobe epilepsy almost always has a lesion, and there's also correlation around very fast oscillations and lesions. So for instance, there are several experiments by Braggin and colleagues where they apply kynic acid to rat hippocampus, and then of the rats that develops very fast oscillations around the lesions, then those, then they develop epilepsy eventually. So let's see here. First one, in all six rats where the electrodes are movable, fast ripples are found around the lesion. So there's also a link between fast ripples over 250 hertz and epilepsy. So the fast ripples are found around the lesion whenever they could look for them. And also in this other experiment, out of the 19 rats that showed very fast oscillations, those 19 rats developed epilepsy, and the other rats that had no very fast oscillations did not develop epilepsy. So there was a clear correlation between the two. Okay, so now we get to my work. An axonal plexus is a network of axons connected by gap junctions, and these networks can very easily produce very fast oscillations. So here is an example of a simple model axon. We put the gap junctions in this compartment in the axon here, and we randomly stimulate with a very low rate, about 2 per second per axon. And we model a somatic voltage up there. It affects the excitability of the axon. And for these simulations here, we have about 3,000 cells connected together in a random network. And for the high gap junction conductance and somatic voltage relative excitability, what happens is that you have this whole network of cells, and one of them happens to be stimulated by the external stimulation. And so it fires. It's triggered to fire right away. And because the gap junction conductance is high enough, then all of its neighbors fire. Then all of its neighbors' neighbors fire. And the neighbors' neighbors fire. So you get this expanding wave that goes through the entire network. So this is based on Tim Lewis's work and Roger Trout's work that they mentioned before. So these oscillations are, the mechanism is these expanding waves where every, one wave is started by a single stimulus, takes over the network, and then pretty soon afterward another wave is started, and it goes throughout the whole network without fail. In this lower excitability region, reentrant very fast oscillations or spiral waves can form. So what happens here is you have an expanding wave, and because the gap junction conductance isn't strong enough or the excitability isn't strong enough, they can spontaneously break. Some cell is not able to fire when its neighbor fires, and then around the breaks in the waves, spiral waves can occur. So you have action potentials going around circles in the network. And what's special about these oscillations right here is that I can turn off the external stimulation and the oscillations keep going. And they never stop. So they're persistent. And then when excitability is weak enough, you just have random noise, no oscillations. So, and last but not least, reentrant very fast oscillations, these spiral waves can easily be over 250 hertz, so they can be in the fast ripple range. Okay, so gap junctions in pyramidal cell axons are somewhat controversial. They're hard to find. It's almost like finding a needle in a haystack. There is some evidence for them, however. There's pair recordings inside the somata of layer 5 rat neocortex in about 5% of them, where the somata are right next to each other, you see a gap junction connection, meaning if you depolarize one cell, the other cell depolarizes, and if you hyperpolarize one cell, the other cell hyperpolarizes. This is work done by Wang et al. In 2010. There is immutable labeling evidence of seeing an actual gap junction connecting pyramidal cell axons in the hippocampus. Yeah? That was what? Mossy fibers. Oh, I should be more, okay, specific. Okay. All right, thanks, Roger. There's also evidence for them indicated by spikelets seen in the hippocampus and neocortex. Spikelets are small depolarizations seen in the somata. They're not like synaptic depolarizations. They're much briefer, much faster than the synaptic polarizations. And there's also decoupling evidence in the hippocampus and neocortex. So what I did for my work was take this information and say, well, if there are gap junctions connecting pyramidal cell axons in the neocortex, what could they possibly be doing there? So for instance, if you have this whole network of axons connected to each other and one cell fires, who's to say that it couldn't just propagate through all the cells in the network? And that seems like it would be really redundant, right? Because that means once one cell fires, every cell fires. So there must be some means of controlling propagation somehow, otherwise it'd be very redundant. So there is, going back to the evidence, you see very fast oscillations only during the up states of the slow oscillation, but not during the down states. And you only see them during cortical activation, but not so much when the cortex is at rest. So maybe the somatic polarization is what controls action potential propagation through the gap junctions. So what we do by models, what I will show, is that the somatic voltage can control propagation through gap junctions if they are in the initial segment or the main axon, right below the initial segment. However, the somatic voltage can't control propagation if the gap junctions are off on side collaterals. However, the number of cells connected by uncontrollable gap junctions, often the collaterals, in normal neocortex is relatively small. And what we'll get to for epilepsy is maybe in epilepsy there's a larger number of uncontrollable gap junctions. So the results imply that pyramidal cells can control signals to postsynaptic cells by adjusting their somatic voltage. And too many collateral gap junctions in particular could possibly lead to epilepsy. And we'll get to how that could be. Any questions so far? Okay, so here's how we start out. How could the somatic voltage possibly control spike propagation across gap junctions? Well, our first question is, where could the gap junctions possibly be? They can't be where the myelin is. Myelin is this thick sheath covering the axon. There's no way it could get through. But the axon is unmyelinated in the initial segment for some length of main axon below the initial segment, and also in a number of side collaterals, side branches. So we model the effects of the somatic voltage on spike propagation where the gap junction is in each of these locations in turn. And here's the setup for a simulation. I use a simplified axon model based on pyramidal cell 3D reconstructions from the somatosensory cortex of rats downloaded from neuromorpho.org. And for these, the dimensions of the simplified model are based on those reconstructions. You can put the gap junction between the initial segments up here or in the main axon down here. And the point is I want to adjust the somatic voltage and stimulate one axon and see if the action potential propagated to the next cell. And same thing for here. And for collateral gap junctions, well, if the gap junction is way out on a branch, it's kind of hard to imagine how the soma over here would control a gap junction way out here. However, any action potential that lands into an axon collateral from a gap junction will have to propagate up the axon and eventually invade the main axon. So it's also possible that right here is the make or break point for the action potential, because the main axon is usually a lot thicker than the collateral. So this, if there's any spot where the action potential will fail, it'll be right here. So maybe the soma can either help the action potential along in getting it into the main axon, or it can block it from going into the main axon. Okay. Yeah. Yes, so Tim was talking. Right, so for all of these gap junctions, number one, I'm not working with oscillators at all. Yes, and number two, I'm assuming that these gap junctions are strong enough so that an action potential in one cell can propagate across the gap junction into the other cell. It doesn't just influence the other cell, it can actively propagate into the other cell. So. Is that clear? Any other questions? Okay, so cells are based on 3D reconstructions. Hodgkin-Huxley currents are used throughout, and I vary several different things. I vary the gap junction conductance, the distance of the gap junction from the soma, as well as which collateral I'm stimulating, the somatic voltage, and since I couldn't find in the literature anywhere what the sodium conductance in the axon should be, I vary that as well. Okay, so for each of these models, I want to find a window of control for the gap junctions. So what do I mean by window of control? I want a set of parameters where I can adjust the somatic voltage so that spikes propagate across the gap junction when I want them to, and that they don't propagate when I don't want them to. So for instance, if I stimulate here, I want this voltage, I want spikes to propagate when this voltage is high, and I don't want them to propagate when the voltage is low. So I'm adjusting the sodium conductance so that action potentials don't propagate when the somatic voltage is minus 80 millivolts. So for instance, I have a threshold sodium conductance right here. If it's really high, action potentials propagate no matter what. But if it's lower than this point, then the action potential is blocked. I want action potentials to propagate when the somatic voltage is minus 60. So there's a threshold sodium conductance right here, above which action potentials propagate and below which they do not. And there's a region in between where I can control propagation across the gap junction. So I'm looking for this window right here. And there, I can control propagation. So if I stick the gap junction into the initial segment and I look for the window of control where I can control propagation across the gap junction, then the window of control, the range of sodium conductances is really wide for a large number of gap junction conductances. These are all in a physiological range. And for distances from the soma, this is the x-axis. So that's pretty easy. The gap junction is right next to the soma. If I put the gap junction in the main axon, then the window of control is also fairly wide, not as wide as in the initial segment, but for all these gap junction conductances, then there is some length along the distance from the soma. So for instance, for this gap junction conductance, I can get I can control gap junctions closer to the soma, and as I lower my gap junction conductance, I can control gap junctions a little further away from the soma. Oh, this is nanosiemens. So this is a measure of conductance, how strong the gap junction is. So if I put my gap junction, if I pretend my gap junction is in the collateral and action potentials are coming from the collateral, and I want to see if the soma can control invasion into the main axon, here are the results using the actual 3D reconstructions. And let's focus on this cell right here. This is the window of control for a single cell, for a single axon, for a single collateral. And so if I put the sodium conductance here, I can control action potentials coming from that one particular collateral, and I can happen to control action potentials coming from this collateral too. However, action potentials from this upper collateral right here will always invade. So I can't control action potentials coming from both collaterals at the same time because these two windows don't overlap. And if I look at all these cells, most of the windows don't overlap with each other. So this means that there is no set of parameters that where I can control action potentials coming from all collaterals at the same time. So it's a bad idea. So my result is I can't control action potential. There's no way I can control action potential propagation coming from collaterals. So this gives us some kind of dichotomy, right? We have some gap junctions we can control, and we have some gap junctions that there's no way we can control. But what does that mean for normal neocortex? How many cells could possibly be hardwired together by uncontrollable gap junctions? Well, again, we see very fast oscillations during the up state of slow wave sleep, but not during the down state. So there must be some control going on. There must be some way that we can put a handle on it. So here's a figure from Grenier et al. 2001, same paper that measures very fast oscillations during slow wave sleep. And the amplitude of the oscillations is pretty high when the somatic voltage of one individual cell that they measured is high, but it drops off to almost zero when the somatic voltage is low. Not quite zero, but almost zero. So this is about 1% of the original amplitude, the highest amplitude there is. So, well, okay, that means that maybe 1% of the cells are still producing very fast oscillations during the hyperpolarization phase. But there could still be, you know, cells connected together that are silent. So we'll look at both of those possibilities. Yes? Of course. My heart too, right? Yes? Right. So could you say that again? That, I mean, why would I see IPSPs only in the upstate but not in the downstate? Because I thought you're far away from the what? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Good point. I'll have to write that down when I get off stage. Okay. So putting Roger's comment aside, we'll still use this graph because that's what my talk is built around. Yeah. Over 80 hertz. So for this figure right here, they said they measured 80 to 200 hertz. Though very fast oscillations, loosely, are now termed as anything over 80 hertz. And then some people term fast ripples as over 250 hertz. So that's, I think it's experiment or person dependent. It's not. Yes. Yes. But then how do you know it's there? So one thing that I can say against the devil's advocate is in other papers by Sterion, looking at the slow oscillation and intercellular recordings in and of itself, he says that nothing is going on during the down state. No one is firing. Isn't the inner neurons? Right. Well, Okay. We'll have to talk about this more. Any other questions so far? Yes.
This high frequency and low amplitude is fixed on the low frequency and high amplitude. Right?
Yes.
And is this high frequency kind of around the region area, so it's confined in the local area.
Generally, so that's in yeah. So this is for figure is for normal activity. So there's two different things going on. There are normal very fast oscillations, and then there are abnormal very fast oscillations that you see around the lesion.
So normal high frequency is that confined in the local area, or they are kind of spread around the area?
So that's a very good question. So from this paper right here, looking at the very fast oscillations during the upstate of the slow oscillation, It's not local. It's relatively widespread, and they're relatively synchronized, and they quantify the synchronization. But as far as very fast oscillations during neocortical activation, that has not been quantified yet, necessarily how local it is. And it might, you know, it might range on the strength of stimulus. It's not clear, but there is a lot of literature looking at high gamma and neocortical activations where they're able to pinpoint, they actually have started to pinpoint activation based on whether they see very fast oscillations or not. So there is a correlation between seeing these oscillations and neocortical activation, and it does seem to be very location specific to what part of the neocortex is supposed to be being used at that point. Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Right. Yes. Right. 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 Okay. Any other questions so far? Should we go? Okay. So based on this graph, we're trying to get a handle on how many uncontrollable, how many cells could be hardwired together in normal neocortex. Okay, so in the previous picture, we saw that the amplitude, relative amplitude of the very fast oscillations was about 1% during the down state. And just grabbing some numbers from the literature, the number of pyramidal cells in layer 5, this is a recording in layer 5, so we'll use layer 5 under 1 millimeter squared of cortex is about 20,000. The maximum fraction of cells in a large connected cluster is about 2/3. This is based on one of Traub's papers from a random network. And so 1% times 2/3 times 20,000 is about 130 cells. I'm thinking that we started with 20,000, that's not very much. But there is still a possibility there could be cells hardwired together that are not producing very fast oscillations during the down state. So we'll make an estimate of how many cells could be there. So in order to estimate this, I generated a network model. I grouped cells together, and then I placed them on a pyramidal, on a hexagonal grid. So these represent mini columns. And I connect the cells together randomly. Well, I assign each cell a weight based on length of axon taken from the reconstructions, and then I connect them randomly based on that weight within a certain radius around them. And so we had two mechanisms to generate very fast oscillations. We had expanding waves, and we had spiral waves. Reentrant oscillations. And it's easier to generate a spiral wave. All you need is a cycle in the network. You don't need so many large cells, a large network to have, you know, one of them be stimulated and have a wave propagating. So we're going to look for cycles or circles inside this network. So I'll vary the parameters, number of cells in the column, and P, and I'm going to find the average number of cycles. And then I'll find what is my largest cluster when the average number of cycles is equal to 1. And these are the results. So this is mean largest cluster size and average number of cycles. And the number of cells in my cluster is 70. So I could possibly have 70 cells hardwired together and not produce a very fast oscillation. Above that, I'll probably have a cycle in the network, and they could be producing a very fast oscillation. So because 130 is bigger than 70, I could have about 130 cells connect hardwired together at a time, which is not very much considering. So recap of everything. The somatic voltage can control spike propagation across gap junctions in the initial segment and the main axon, but it can't control propagation coming from gap junctions on collaterals. 130 out of 20,000 is only 0.65% of the cells, so it's not that much. However, if you have more than 70 cells hardwired together, then they can produce persistent very fast oscillations by the reentrant mechanism, and those won't go away with hyperpolarization. So there's an implication for neocortical processing. Here's the same network. The red arrows are collateral connections. Blue arrows are initial segment main axon connections. If all of these black cells are depolarized at the same time and only one of them fires, then an action potential will travel through all of them, all of their axons, and the soma doesn't have to fire. So all of these cells act as a unit if they're all depolarized together. And if you have a large number of cells depolarized together, then you have a large enough network that can produce very fast oscillations. So if you have a large enough cortical activation, that's why you can see the oscillation. And if you have the very fast oscillations, then that could affect cells downstream because they're sending tetanic stimulation. This might help with learning or synaptic plasticity. So on the flip side, implications for temporal lobe epilepsy. So what happens if you have gap junctions connecting collaterals together so that they form a cycle? So if you think about it, if you do have gap junctions connecting the collaterals, it's really easy to have a spike propagating around in the cycle. So here's two cells right here, and suppose this soma fires. Then the spike travels down the axon and goes up this collateral up here and up here. And then, usually I need two pointers. Okay. So the spike goes across both these gap junctions. And across this gap junction here, the spike travels down and it gets blocked because the main axon here is really thick compared to the little side collateral, so it can't quite invade the main axon here. However, the spike that traveled across this gap junction here happens to land in the collateral that's lower down. The main axon is not so thick here. It doesn't have so much of a jump to go through. And so then this spike up here failed, and then this spike down here can travel around this collateral and then go around the circle and then perpetuate until, I don't know. So it's relatively easy to get very fast oscillations in this mechanism just because of the geometry of the axons. And if you have small groups of cells that may have cycles in normal neocortex, it's a possibility. However, if you have axonal sprouting, then you can have a lot more collaterals. So, axonal sprouting near a lesion. This is from Salinal, 1995, did a study with axonal sprouting by doing cortical lesions, and there was a 56% increase in axon length, and the number of collaterals increased greatly. So, here's my hypothesis. Since the somatic voltage can't control spike propagation from collaterals, axonal sprouting may lead to more gap junctions on the collaterals than you have in normal neocortex. That would mean more cycles formed by gap junctions that are just connecting the collaterals together. So you can't control these gap junctions, so you can have large amplitude reentrant oscillations going around these collaterals that cannot be turned off by somatic hyperpolarization. They would persist. And finally, these very fast oscillations would not only just, you know, produce synaptic plasticity, but could possibly kindle the postsynaptic cells, which may lead to epilepsy. So this is my conclusion, and thanks. I'd like to acknowledge Nancy Capels, my previous mentor, Roger Traub, who has helped with this project, and also Yun Wang, who discussed her work with me on pyramidal cell gap junctions. Thank you. Yes.
I have a question about your main hypothesis.
Yes.
Which is generating an oscillation one spike at a time and getting the spike to move around your collateral.
Mm-hmm.
Which is possible, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have to come up with a mechanism to say when will it stop and how will it stop. Because the stopping of that is as crucial as initiating it.
So, right. So the thing is that.
And also, clinically, that ripple tends to be brief.
Do they tend to be brief?
Yeah.
So that's a very good question that I do not know right now. So for this model right here, I mean, these are the reentrant very fast oscillations, and you can stop them by hyperpolarization. So that's blocking the connections. If you block the spirals, then, you know, you can't go anywhere. Or the gap junction conductance. As for fast ripples being brief around a lesion, so that is something that I do not know yet and would love to find out, that if you do get these persistent oscillations, what does stop them eventually? Do they get exhausted? Out of juice? Which juice? I mean, this is a mathematical model, so it literally goes on forever, but biophysically. Oh, yeah? Well, they can. Right, right. Well, in the larger network, the reentrant oscillation spontaneously started and stopped as well. But what?
I don't know why they stopped. Because sometimes it's both soma and fire at the same time. So then both get your activate at the same time. So they can't activate each other. It's not propagating through the soma.
Right. Well, it's almost a random process. I mean, in my simulations, if I still have the stimulation going, then the reentrant oscillations could spontaneously stop because some spike was produced that happened to be at the right moment that just happened to cancel things out. But if I turned off the external stimulation, it literally could go on forever.
The problem with this is it's not, I don't think it's simple reentry.
Yeah. Right, but.
So then that's what you're saying. That would imply that you are talking about oscillators. That's what I'm trying to get at.
No, we are not talking about.
End, you have to. You have to stop it. So there must be something else. That is controlling.
A fast oscillation is much more demanding metabolically, because they burn up more fuel, more ATP than slow oscillations, and eventually it will run out of juice.
Go ahead, Tim.
But they are fast.
The frequency depends on the length of the reduced.
The length?
They compare to the estimated propagation time around the
So the frequency around the lesions, I mean, they say like above 250, and I think that they mentioned, I think you said 500 hertz or something like that. Right. And in my model, the oscillations from the topological target patterns, I mean, they were about just below 100 to, you know, a little over 200 hertz, but the reentrant oscillations could go well above that, up to, I think I had instances like 400 hertz or something like that.
So my question is, the frequency will depend on the loop that is generating.
Right. So it depends on the loop that's generating the reentry, and it also depends on the refractory period. And so, yes, there are many cycles in the network. It's a random network with many cycles. There's millions of cycles, and I tried to quantify the cycles as well, but I was able to find with the reentrant oscillations, you could find a cycle that is generating the oscillation. And so the action potential goes around the cycle and then the action potentials propagate away from that cycle. And it was the smallest cycle that worked. But that cycle, if something didn't work with that cycle for any reason, then it would just jump to another cycle, or it could stop altogether. So. Right.
Yes, so it's experimental. What's the variation in the high frequency oscillation? How does that compare to estimates in modeling intermediate?
Yeah, it's amazingly good, but even though it's just, I mean, well, for those estimates are made from the simpler model, but I'm. If you count here, you'd have to count the propagation time down one axon and over to another, but it should still be pretty fast, right? Yes.
Aaron,
yeah.
Just put in this question, I don't like anybody in the audience knows it.
Uh-huh.
There must be some gap junction blockers that were used in all the systems. Did anyone find high frequency oscillations in the presence of gap junction blockers? That's the core of your receiver.
All the ones I'm aware of are the oscillations are blocked by gap junction blockers. And then other people say, oh, they're messy, we don't really know what they're doing. But as far as I know.
So they work.
Yeah.
The problem is there's no in vitro model of type system. We can't use it as kind of
Mm-hmm. Yes, Steve.
So, help me out here. This sounds like an interesting dark matter problem. and I don't see what. Is this structure is so small, and the requirement to spatially temporally record, if it has to be this optically, are so difficult to. Load the tissue with voltage sensitive dye and exceed it. We certainly aren't going to individually fill the neurons, as a couple of people I know are able to do, and get enough collateral fills to see it.
Well, collaterals are so thin that almost no experimentalist would touch them right now. But
there are people.
So for instance, if you could see that the axon was active without the soma, then that would also lend credence to this theory. Okay. But, I mean, I think that there are voltage-sensitive dyes that are fast enough to capture this. I mean, I've seen papers showing propagating waves at this level, so. But, I mean, with the dyes that are just blanketing, you can't see the individual cells. Anyway.
I think it's something. I was very interested by how much there is a polyvalent
speakers.
Okay. So, I think I can just
take this off, right?